I'd like to begin by acknowledging traditional owners of the land where Let's Talk is broadcast, the Jagera Yagera and Turrbal peoples and other First Nations mob around southeast Queensland and indeed around the country who are maybe listening through the National Indigenous Radio Service. I'd also like to pay my respects to our elders. And as you heard, this is Let's Talk. My name is Karen Durante. Your regular host, Tiger Bales, is out of the office all week. We'll be back on deck next Tuesday. In the meantime, let's welcome today's guests here on Let's Talk. I'll tell you a little bit more of what's planned for Let's Talk, by the way, later this morning. Dr. James Ward is Deputy Director of the Baker IDI Health and Diabetes Institute and convener of the Australasian Sexual Health Conference held in Darwin last week. Dr. Ward, welcome to Let's Talk.
Yeah, good morning.
Firstly, tell us your mob.
Yeah, so I'm from Central Australia, from Pinjarra and Narunga clans of both Central Australia and South Australia. So, I'm pretty much up the centre of Australia.
All right, and tell us how did you? Well, tell us a bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? Where were you born?
Yeah, I was born here in Alice Springs Hospital, and now on the board of Alice Springs Hospital. And so I've been away, studied and come back just in the last 2 years, come back to Alice Springs. And, always had a kind of strong connection to Alice. Still got a big mob here and went away to Sydney and worked at the university down there, went to Perth previous to that. And, I kind of realised a few years ago that there was an opportunity here to come back and work with the mob that I'm working with now, and it's good to be back home.
And tell us, your parents encouraged you to go to university, that sort of thing. What happened there? How did you?
Yeah, no, I well, really, first one really in my family to go to university, and I guess people like Mum and all of her sisters and brothers never had the opportunity as we did, and they really encouraged us. We had some very encouraging teachers here, and it kind of always had an interest in learning, and still continue to learn. And my grandfather once said to me, "The day you stop learning is the day you may as well die." So it's a continual process.
So you got a Western education. What about a Aboriginal education? Yeah. You got that too?
Oh yeah, that still continues every single day as well. I'm always pulled into line, and for doing the wrong things or doing not the right things, or always pulled into line, and I always check with things before last week. I was the convener of a national conference last week. Always checked with family about what's going to happen over the next week, and how to say things the right way, and make sure we don't stigmatise our mob. I'm very conscious of all those kind of things.
Mm. So, what did you want to be as you were going to school in Alice?
Yeah, I didn't really know, to be honest. I kind of fell into this role. I've always been in, some of my aunties are all health workers out at Hammersburg and Daria, and always kind of was involved in health from an early age. And one of my first jobs was in sexual health as a sexual health worker and educator out in remote. And I just grew this very strong interest in trying to make things better, and I ended up in this role here now as a researcher and deputy director of Baker IDI here in Alice Springs, and feel like we're trying to make a big difference. I know that we're trying to make a big difference. We haven't seen the results yet of quite a lot of work, but we're still moving in the right direction, I think.
Mm. And tell us, how long ago were you a sexual health worker, and what sort of issues were you dealing with then?
Yeah, I guess about 20 years ago we were, 20 years ago we were dealing with the same. So this was in Central Australia here, and we were dealing with very high rates of sexually transmitted infections that we knew of, so chlamydia and gonorrhea. And at that time, HIV was relatively new, and it was certainly new for remote Australia. And so what we were dealing with then is, a lot of stigma associated with HIV and a lot of misinformation or no information out in communities. And, Yeah, we're still dealing with very high rates of STIs in communities, that's for sure.
Mm.
But I think we've got a much more sophisticated approach. What we did to address HIV in those days was really trying to get the message out there, and really about STIs and HIV. But what we did specifically around HIV was to get people informed about it. So we embarked on making, I led the men's part of this, but embarked on making videos in different language groups around here in Central Australia, and then the top end followed in trying to get what HIV was, how you can transmit it, how you can avoid it, and you know, to understand that it that people in remote communities were not immune from HIV. So we made a whole lot of videos, and that was one of the best things I've done early in the early days. I thought was a very good thing, because we got really the right blokes to say the message. And the same thing was done for women, but I didn't lead that process. Yeah.
Yet we're still grappling with these issues 20 years down the track. I mean, at your conference last week, we heard that, you know, chlamydia is, you know, extremely high in our communities. What's going on there? Apart from the obvious.
Yeah. So we've, compared to the other, compared to white fellows, we've got very high rates of chlamydia and particularly gonorrhea. And what we do know is the rates of chlamydia are about three times higher in the cities among Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people, and about seven times higher in remote communities. So that's for chlamydia. Chlamydia affects young people. It's a very heterosexually acquired infection. It's largely asymptomatic, so it doesn't show any symptoms. And people don't often know that they've got chlamydia. And in terms of gonorrhea, we don't see too much of it among Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people in the cities, but what we do see is quite a lot of it in outer regional areas and in remote and very remote communities. And again, that one is a very heterosexually acquired infection. You know, it does show symptoms, but people often don't recognise what those symptoms are.
Mm.
And why we haven't got it down is a million-dollar question. We've tried different things over the years. Lots of people have tried different things over the years. But I do think it's, you know, it's not really about, you know, risks. Factors, you know, obviously people are not using condoms all the time, but that's one thing. But I do think that it we often put the blame on communities when really our health service systems are not really fully equipped to address the complexities of this of these infections.
All right.
The
so
other thing, yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
I was just going to ask you, James. How does one? What's involved in screening and testing for chlamydia?
Yeah, so it's pretty simple. It's it's really just taking a urine sample from someone once they're in the clinic and sending it off to the laboratory. And same with gonorrhea, really. There's no swabs involved anymore. All women do take swabs, but for blokes it's really urine, and for women it's urine as well. And very easy to test for, and you get your results. And if you do have chlamydia and gonorrhea, it's really a matter of taking some tablets and getting it cleared up and getting your partners treated so you don't get reinfected. So that's really what we need to do. It seems like a simple job, but it's actually a very difficult task, given there's lots of shame and stigma and issues associated with having an STI.
And is that where health service are struggling? You think that people aren't coming forward to use those services to get tested and to check that they are free of an STI?
Yeah, so what we do know is that young women are attending health services, and about 40-50% overall in remote, for instance, are being tested. But that leaves another 40-50% who are not tested once they're in the clinic. And then, of course, there's a whole lot of other people who don't come to the clinic. So that's one issue for women. And the second issue for blokes is that blokes are not attending the clinics as often, about a third less than women. But the really interesting thing we found from a study here in the Northern Territory and Cape York and the Kimberley, it's one very large study, is that even when blokes do attend the clinic, they're tested at half the rate of women when they attend the clinics. And I think, you know, there's some really structural barriers there. So we know that a lot of women, a lot of the staff that work in remote clinics are women, and so young blokes might not be offered testing because of the, you know, cultural differences, and they might not, and young blokes might not feel comfortable, and the female nurses might not feel they're the right person to offer the test. So there's a lot of complexities around issues like that that we need to kind of sort through and work out what we can do better.
Mm. And at this conference that last week that you convened, it was an Australasian one, so not only were groups from Australia there, but I assume from other worlds, I mean other countries, other worlds.
Yeah, we didn't have too many other First Nations peoples from around the globe, but we had presentations from the Philippines, from the guy that's in charge of the global fund to address HIV/AIDS, addresses via video conference. We had Americans. We had some quite a large contingent from Cambodia. We had some from China. Yes, so we had 122 delegates from overseas at the conference last week out of the 885 or so delegates at the conferences.
And were there any who any of those presentations deal with that issue of gender and cultural differences, and you know that tackled that issue of men perhaps not getting tested because the person the health worker was female?
I should say that there are a large number of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander delegates at the conference, and I think many of these delegates know what the issues are for communities, and they we had a very nice showcase of health promotion and program responses that was opened on Tuesday morning by the local peak Aboriginal health organisation, AMSANT, and what that really showed is that there are different programs and approaches to addressing rates of STI testing and HIV. In Aboriginal communities, and so that was really in the main foyer area of the Darwin Convention Centre, where lots of issues there, and Condo Man and Lubelicious and all the SDI characters were there on display for the 3 days of the conference. So it was, there are lots of people are aware of that issue, and we've just been funded for a new grant. And one of the things we're really trying to work out is will incentives make young blokes come to the clinic more often? And if we offer an incentive for a second test once they've tested positive to come back, will that make a difference? Because one thing we do know is that reinfection rates are quite high in communities.
All right. Well, you mentioned Condo Man and Lubelicious. We might take a break, and since we are talking about sexual health, I don't know whether you had an opportunity to have a listen to the work that we're doing here at the station, but we have a project called Condom Man Says, and we're trying to tackle those issues, get information out there in the community about STIs and bloodborne viruses. So we're going to take a break, have a listen to a Condom Man radio skit you may have heard, but here it is, and we'll come back to Dr. James Ward in just a moment.
Condo Man, deadly protector of your sexual health.
Oh, shame, he said the S word, sexual.
And his sidekick, the deadly slippery sister, Lubelicious.
Lubelicious, slip over here.
Yes, Condo Man?
We're here in community to see how effective our education program on STIs is with our mob.
Hey, Sissy, how did you deal with your STI?
I gave a blood sample and a pee sample to the doctor. Then I got a diagnosis and treatment.
And that's no shame.
Not at all. Who wants to live with an STI?
And you know what to do now when you get with your boyfriend?
I take control and make sure he wears a condom.
And the water-based lubricant.
Of course.
And what about you, brother? What did you do when you tested positive for HIV?
I contacted the Two Spirits team. They calmed me down and gave me good advice about who I need to talk to, about getting the right support and health plan for me. They're deadly, them mob.
Well, Lubelicious, it looks like our message is getting through. Get smart and get a sexual health checkup.
And stop STIs.
Up, up, and on.
Remember, don't be shame, be game. Use condoms and water-based lubricants to protect your family and culture from STIs and HIV.
This message is supported by Two Spirits and the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health, and is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health and Ageing.
Karen Durante with you, and I'm with Dr. James Ward, who's an Indigenous health researcher. He's the Deputy Director at the Baker IDI Health and Diabetes Institute in Alice Springs, and prior to that was at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales. He's also been advising government also on STIs and bloodborne viruses. In fact, that Condoman Says message that we heard earlier there was actually came under the strategy, the 2010 and 2013 STIs and bloodborne viruses strategy that you advised the government on.
Yeah, that's right. We're in the process of developing the new one right now.
Yes.
And so, it's a bit of work, and we just had a bit of a consultation up in Darwin last week as well as part of the conference.
And which direction do you think that we're going with this strategy, or what direction do you think you'd like to see it go? Because there's been a lot of, one could say, a lot of investment in closing the gap, and I wonder whether, you know, sexual health, sexual reproduction, that sort of thing is a high priority for governments. Both state and territory and Commonwealth.
Yeah, it kind of was left off that closed the gap agenda, really, the high rates of STIs and bloodborne viruses, I guess, recognising that's a bit of different outside chronic disease. And, you know, STIs really don't have the potential to, people don't die of STIs except if you acquire HIV and you don't look after your health. But it kind of was left off that agenda, so we've really been struggling along the sidelines here. But the Minister, Plibersek, just before Labor lost the last election, announced a whole suite of opportunity to increase the amount of activity in remote and urban communities across Australia around Aboriginal STIs and bloodborne viruses. And so we're still waiting to hear on the outcomes of what that might eventuate into.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some hope down the pathway. In terms of the national strategy, I think not much has changed. I think we need to maintain our focus on high rates of STIs. We need to maintain our focus on preventing HIV. And we do need to do something about the high rates of hepatitis in communities, both hepatitis C and B.
Mm. Well, there were also some new figures that came out as well about HIV infection rates. A big increase in compared to, you know, what is it, 20 years or something or other? Biggest increase? And that old institute there, Kirby Institute, that research?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I still work with the Kirby as an advisor kind of role, and so we launched the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Surveillance Report last week at the conference, and what we did know from 2012's data is that ever since we started collecting data, which is 1992 on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander status, is that there's always been around 20 notifications of HIV across the country every single year, and in 2012 we had 32. Now, we don't know whether that's a huge blip, or we don't know whether it's just a blip in the data, or really is that the start of something that might escalate. And I think we should be concerned either way. And, we've always had around 20. So the average number of notifications over the last 10 years has been 21 per year. Doesn't seem a lot, but it's actually the same rate for the non-Indigenous population. So I think we need to be a little bit concerned and be watching very closely this space. I mean, we have been watching this space for very closely for a long time, but it is a bit of a concern given that another 10 or so new notifications.
Yeah, yeah. And what's happening in terms of, HIV testing, treatment, and just the general quality of life for people who have HIV?
Yeah, so things have changed dramatically since the early days. You used to get HIV, if you acquired HIV in the early days, you didn't have very much of a longevity in lifespan. But actually now people who acquire HIV and they manage their illness well with treatment, you can almost expect to live to the same life expectancy as you would without HIV. So it's much better in terms of the treatment, and treatment is much less toxic now. And, you know, there's lots and lots of research around the world around HIV. We still have 32 million people globally infected with HIV, and we still have another 2 million new diagnoses every year. So we've still got a lot of work to do, and we know that about a lot of people, about 50% of people in the world, don't have access to treatment. And so we've got a lot to do. In terms of Australia, you know, again, in the last few years, the rates of notifications have increased in the Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal population. Not as much for ours, except for last year, but in the non-Aboriginal population, rates are increasing. So, you know, it's a bit of a wake-up call, given that we've got the International AIDS Conference coming to Australia next year for the first time ever in 25 years. And, you know, it's a... I think we need to really look at what we're doing and doing it more sophisticated.
And it could be a, you know, variety of reasons why those infection rates are increasing. Could it be that, you know, the longevity is, you know, the treatment is better and that sort of thing? People are a bit more, not relaxed, but complacent.
Yeah, so they say there's a number of issues, and one thing they do say, that the rate of new infections is not increasing because of increased testing. So they actually say it's a result of more infections in the community, not as a result of detecting more. And unfortunately, the groups that are most affected are younger people. And so we, you know, in the early days, we had the, maybe you'll remember, but the Grim Reaper ad, and that... promoted a lot of discussion in the community, in the Australian community, about HIV.
Yep.
And the new generation have missed out on that, and I think we really need to get some kind of discussion starter happening around HIV for younger people. Young gay guys in the communities, not in Aboriginal communities, but certainly in the non-Aboriginal community, are driving the new increases in infection. So we do need to think about what we're doing and think about it more. You know, strategically.
Well, certainly, I mean, the dialogue from our Indigenous leaders seems to be getting a job and better health, but there's in things like depression, mental health, all that kind of stuff, but the bit that keeps the population growing doesn't get talked about.
Absolutely, yeah. So one thing I did say in my talk last week was that we don't need to go down the path of where Canada's First Nations people have gone in terms of HIV.
And so, what's that? Sorry, James, what's that?
Yeah. And so Canada's First Nations peoples, so Aboriginal and Inuit and Métis, and really they make up 3% of the total Canadian population, but 18% of all the HIV notifications in Canada are among First Nations peoples, and that's a really massive overrepresentation of HIV in the First Nations community in Canada. And what that really has stemmed from is the high rates of injecting drug use in communities and transmission of HIV through injecting. And so it moves from the injecting population into the heterosexual population, and so it's very much a different epidemic from Australia. It's a really among heterosexual people, either through injecting drug use or through heterosexually acquired sex. We have to listen and learn from Canada and really think about what we're doing. And so this, in the last year, the new number of notifications have increased. I think we have to take it very, very seriously and work out what we're doing here in Australia.
Well, James, imagine that you're talking to a young person now. I mean, how would you broach this topic and explain to a young person that they ought to get tested? Particularly, I suppose, that message becomes very important once they start getting, you know, getting sexually active.
Yeah. So I think it's our, I think it's all of our responsibilities in community. It's like, it's not really only the people that work in health. It's all of our aunties, our mothers, our fathers, our uncles, everyone needs to be talking about it. And so if you've got young people and you have some influence, I think you should be saying things like, You're going to have, if you're going to meet someone new, you need to use condoms. You need to get tested. You need to know your status. If you know people who are injecting drugs in the community, you need to kind of say to them, have you been tested? Are you injecting safely? Are you not sharing? That's really the key messages. And for people who know young gay fellas and, you know, particularly people in, I'm not sure if this is broadcast to rural and regional areas, but if you know people who, young gay fellas who are living in those areas, in regional and rural areas, they might not have as much access to education and so forth. But if they're going to the city, they need to make sure that if they're going to meet people in the city, that they have safe sex, especially among gay men in the city, where we do know that prevalence of HIV is much higher than anywhere else in regional areas. And particularly, as I said before, young guys might think that they're, you know, it only affects older gay guys, but really the new data really suggests that younger gay guys in the cities are the group most affected by these latest rounds of increases in HIV.
And the, how can I approach this? The way that people can connect with each other or hook up these days a little bit easier these days with social media as well. So the mind just boggles.
Yeah, so it's quick, it's fast, and but the thing that even more so in these situations where chat lines and other kind of apps on phones and so forth, people need to still remember that safe sex is the number one prevention message. So you need to use condoms. If you're going to meet somebody, you need to use condoms, particularly in those environments. It might be convenient, but you absolutely need to take condoms. You need to take responsibility and use condoms. You don't expect other people to always have condoms. And in the heat of the moment, you might think it's okay, but you just never do know. Once you've got HIV, you live with it for the rest of your life. And it's, you know, it's not a good thing to do. It's there's a lot of shame and stigma attached to HIV still.
Mm.
And we need to really make sure that safe sex is the number one message.
Mm.
Not only for HIV, for, you know, for chlamydia and gonorrhea and you know, syphilis in communities. They can cause poor outcomes for young women, and particularly if they're thinking about having babies, you know, later on down the track, need to really think about safe sex.
Mm. And these days when we talk about the safe, you know, use a condom, but there's the added message now of use some water-based lubricant to the message that Lubalicious is carrying through.
Yep, she's got a very important message. So, it's really important to have both condoms and water-based lube in these situations. So it's just need to be a little bit prepared. If you're going out for a night out, you know, just need to be a little bit prepared if you're thinking of meeting someone new. Young people have always enjoyed sex. We don't want to stop people from having sex. We just need to do it very safely these days. There's many more infections around now than there ever were before, and just need to be a bit more prepared.
Mm. And in terms of condoms these days, I mean, or people's knowledge about the correct usage of condoms, is that message getting out there? I mean, are fellas still carrying around condoms in their wallets of 20 years ago, or are we a little bit more sophisticated or knowledgeable about these things now?
Yeah, so we just completed a national survey of young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Almost 3,000 people completed the survey, and what we found is that people in the younger age groups have got fairly good condom use. People are using condoms reasonably well, about 50% of using condoms at the last sexual encounter. It still leaves 50% who are not at their last sexual encounter, and I guess we just need to increase that. There's a whole network of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander sexual health workers, including the Two Spirits team at Quack, who have been promoting Lubalicious and Condo Men. Mm-hmm. They're out in communities all the time trying to promote these messages, and if you people feel a bit uncomfortable about these messages, then maybe get in contact with your local sexual health workers who are located in both Aboriginal Medical Services and with Queensland Health, and get them to come out to schools or to community groups and talk about these kind of issues, because they're the ones that really have a really important role about getting these messages out.
Mm. Before, James, you were talking about incentivising, you know, young men particularly to go in and get screened for STIs. Have there been any groups who've tried to do that you're aware of, any Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander mobs who've tried to do that, and whether that's been working?
Yeah, so I guess the Cape York communities have been running a screening program for a number of years now, and what they do is pay people, young people, for instance, a phone charger, a phone recharge voucher to have their STI test. That's been very successful. They've had fairly high testing rates in the Cape York communities, but it's never been kind of rolled out specifically for men and really trialled among men, and also for having the second test. You know, if you test positive once, you need to kind of come back at 3 months, and that's where we do know that people don't often come back for the second test. So we're going to trial if we pay somebody to come back for their second test, does it make a big impact on reinfection rates in the community? And I think we might find some differences there. We might find some success in that way.
All right. And have you been looking at other health programs? I mean, I'm looking at over here in Queensland, we've got the Deadly Choices, the Hero Rewards as well. I mean, that's for obviously tackling chronic disease and encouraging people to get their general health check. But, I wonder whether you've been looking in other fields of health.
I do know those programs a little bit. But, I do know that... use of the heroes and the use of sporting personalities have been successful. The phone chargers in the Cape, I do know that they do make a bit of a difference. And this is what hasn't been trialled among young people in these communities, so it'd be good to work out whether it does or not.
Mm. You're listening to Let's Talk here on the National Indigenous Radio Service, NON 98.9 FM. I'm with Dr. James Ward, Deputy Director of the Baker IDI Health and Diabetes Institute. When we come back, James, we might get you to explain what the Institute is about as well. So stay with us here on Let's Talk. My name is Karen Durante, and Tiger Bales, your regular host, as I mentioned, is away all this week. He'll be back presenting next Tuesday, but over this coming week we'll have the aunties on the show tomorrow, a repeat of one of their chats. We'll also have discussion about empowered communities and native title. That's coming up, I believe, on Wednesday. I'll just check with you and confirm that later this morning. Not that we have much time left for this show, but certainly that's a glimpse of what's happening this week on Let's Talk. Dr. James Ward is with us, Deputy Director of the Baker IDI Health and Diabetes Institute. Tell us a bit about the Institute, James.
Yeah, so Baker IDI is a one of the largest medical research institutes in Australia. It's based, its head office is in Melbourne, and there's about 700 staff in Melbourne, and really focused on chronic disease and heart and diabetes stuff, really. And they do everything from basic laboratory science right through to population health. And Baker IDI board of directors decided a few years ago that they really wanted to make a solid commitment to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health in Australia. Mm. So they really put their money where their mouths were, and they built an institute here in Alice Springs, and they wanted to really demonstrated that they were here for the long term. They wanted to make a difference, and they wanted to respond to local communities' needs here in research in Alice Springs. So we've got a much broader remit than just chronic disease, mm-hmm. much broader than just diabetes and cardiovascular, although a lot of our work is focused on that.
Yep.
I'm here in Alice Springs, and my area of work is STIs and bloodborne viruses.
Is this fairly new area for them, or had they been working in this field?
No, this is a very new area, and the reason I said, I came back in a couple of years ago, really is... they approached me whether I wanted to come back, and I thought, why not? And, it's a good opportunity to broaden their remit and to work here in communities where the need is great, and to still have a voice from From the centre of Australia, I guess, is really good. We're really trying to increase our visibility in communities and respond really much to the needs of local communities. And so last year, for instance, housing was raised as an important issue, requiring extra research around. And, you know, we're trying to respond to that now. We're doing some other work in the hospital here, trying to prevent readmission rates in Alice Springs Hospital. And, you know, there's a whole lot of other issues that need to be addressed here. Being based here doesn't mean that I don't I can do work wherever. It's not really just focused on Central Australia, although the needs of Central Australia are big. People in a lot of those communities are over. They've got lots of research projects in them, and so I can work from anywhere here. I can work anywhere in Australia from here.
All right. And that survey of 3,000 young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, that's the Gowanna survey, is it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And who does that?
So I got the funding from the Australian Research Council a few years back, and what we did was thought that we needed to do this research differently.
Yeah.
So I basically said to the quakes of the around the country, you know, the Queensland Aboriginal Islander Health Council, and the AHNMRC and the AMSANT and BACHO and AXA and Tasmanian Aboriginal Corporation.
Yep.
Here's some money. This is what we want you to do. We want you to survey young Aboriginal people around these things. We're going to provide you with the support to run this, but I want you to have young Aboriginal people involved in the running this survey in each of your states and territories.
Yep.
And so that's what happened. And we had young Aboriginal people involved. And last week we had three of the young people present the first findings of Gowanna last week in Darwin. So it was a very good process in terms of engaging young people in research and in terms of Aboriginal people running and controlling the research.
Absolutely. So this is going. Was it a one-off thing, or do you hope that that we'll look at this issue again over what period of time? Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's good to do it one-off. It's we've never had any information at a global kind of level.
So this is kind of like the baseline.
Yeah. This is absolutely baseline. Mm. What we haven't worked out yet is how we get the funding for the next round, and how often we do it, you know, so maybe it's good to do monitor trends over time to see if there's any differences in over time. And so we haven't quite worked out that, but we are in conversations with the Commonwealth Government, and perhaps we'll continue that with research funding as well.
Any chance, have you met with the new Health Minister, Peter Dutton, and is he making the right noises, so to speak?
Yeah, no, I haven't personally met with Peter Dutton. I sit on the Ministerial Advisory Committee for STIs and bloodborne viruses, which is advice to the Health Minister.
Yep.
We do have a meeting, our first meeting in December, on the 2nd of December, so that will be our first opportunity to see what the new government's direction is and for us to understand priorities for the new government.
Right. All right, then. Well, look, James, we appreciate the time that you've spent with us this morning, bring us up to speed with this issue. I guess the take-home message is go and get tested if you haven't already been tested.
Yeah, absolutely. And use safes and use condoms all the time.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
No worries. Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Dr. James Ward, who's the convener of the conference last week held in Darwin, the Australasian Sexual Health Conference, and also Deputy Director of the Baker IDI Health and Diabetes Institute based in Alice Springs. Coming up, as I mentioned, tomorrow will be a repeat of the aunties chat. Again, there's a discussion about empowered communities and native title. We'll also bring you our special on the Commonwealth Games protests anniversary. So I hope you can stay listening to Let's Talk throughout the week, even though Tiger is on the road travelling, and he will be back, of course, next Tuesday here on Let's Talk. I'm Karen Durante. Thanks for listening to Let's Talk.